Hey folks, grab a bowl of your favorite sugary cereal and join us for Saturday Morning Fever. I'm your host for this episode, the Irredeemable Shag, and my apologies to you for this is technically a Sunday release, not on a Saturday. I know the show's called Saturday Morning Fever and all that, but really the show's sort of on demand. You can listen to it anytime you want. So really, I feel like you could have listened to this anytime you wanted and you could have listened to it on a Saturday. So if it's not Saturday for you right now, it's really kind of your fault, not mine, you know? Anyway, I feel bad because we don't do this show often enough, and with that insanely cool theme song by Luke Dobb, it really deserves to be played more often. So we are all making a concerted effort here at the network to try and step up our game and do some more episodes of this show. Today, we are going to be covering a very memorable episode, at least for me, of the Super Friends from my misspent youth, and I'm not doing it alone, thank goodness for you. Today, I am joined by the amazingly talented author of the young adult adventure series, The Only Living Boy, and now the upcoming series entitled The Only Living Girl. Plus, he's a writer of the werewolf western series High Moon, and he's done work for DC Comics, Marvel Comics, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Harris Publications, McGraw-Hill, and so many more. And he is now the reoccurring co-host on the podcast For the Love of Comics. I don't know why he keeps wasting his time with me, but I'm thankful he does. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Mr. David Gallagher. David.
Yay!
Thank you so much for being here, David. I appreciate it.
No problem. It's my pleasure. I'm super excited about today's show, so I'm ready to engage in on-demand special that could be on a Saturday, could be on a Friday, could be on a Sunday. I'm super thrilled.
As long as you've got your bowl of sugary cereal, it works.
What if you have like a bowl of oatmeal? Does that count?
As long as it's maple and brown sugar, because then it's sugary. See how that works?
Oh, nice. I'm picking up what you're laying down. I like how you're like how you're thinking.
Excellent. Now, this episode kind of came about because over on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, my buddy Rob Kelly and I did an episode about Super Friends not too long ago that had a firestorm, which was awesome. Then Mr. Gallagher here starts posting all kinds of amazingly cool Super Friends stuff over on Twitter. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, I got a kooky idea. Would you do this with me? And he said, absolutely. And, you know, it really, if you step back and think about this, we're discussing Super Friends, right? And we have an actual published writer that has written comics for DC Comics. This man has written Hal Jordan in published comic books, The Green Lantern from Super Friends. How awesome is that? That he can bring his insight of Hal Jordan in the comics discussing it in the Super Friends, except that I made sure I picked an episode without Hal. Sorry about that.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, all part of my evil plan to take Hal Jordan back out. I'm part of Heat now, or whatever the opposite of Heat was.
Freeze?
I don't know. Those were horrible years. None of us want to go back to that time, do we really?
No.
All right. Well, before we get much further, we should probably take a second to thank our sponsor. Folks, this episode of the Saturday Morning Fever podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. What'd you bring, David?
Today, I brought Superpowers by Jack Kirby.
Woohoo!
I don't know if you've ever read it, since we're talking about the Super Friends anyway.
Right.
It's one of my all-time favorite toy lines, and it's absolutely like the synchronicity with Super Friends is undeniable. So in 1984, legendary writer and artist Jack Kirby returned to DC to illustrate the tales of the Justice League and the powers of Super Friends. At last, DC collects the two Superpowers miniseries in a single collected volume. They take the Justice League, Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, The Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, Man and more against Darkseid, the Lord of Apocalypse, and his evil acolytes. Wait, Firestorm is one of Firestorm is one of Darkseid's evil minions?
Just finish your bit. Oh my gosh.
Anyway, these stories are the only time in Kirby's long career that he would draw the Justice League. So these stories are super legendary. It collects Superpowers Volume 1, Issues 1 through 5, and Superpowers of Volume 2, Issues 1 through 6. It's written and illustrated by Jack Kirby. It was $39.99, and your in-stock trades price is $23.19, which means you save a whopping, amazing, and astonishing 42%.
That's awesome. And it's such a cool collection. You asked, you mentioned earlier that you weren't sure if I had read or not. That second Superpowers miniseries was one of my gateway drugs into the bigger DC universe. Because I was reading Firestorm originally, then I tried Crisis, and I was reading Crisis in parallel with Superpowers 2, not issue 2, but the second miniseries, because it had Firestorm in it, and it had Dr. Dr. Fate, and it had all these great characters, and it was just, you know, the Easter Island heads, and it's just so much stinking fun.
Oh, that Easter Island head thing is the craziest.
Isn't it awesome?
Issue. Yeah.
So good. So, yes, definitely, I second your pick there. That's a great choice, and perfectly in line with Super Friends. Mine is going to seem a little odd until we get into the episode, but my pick is Batman 66 meets Wonder Woman 77 trade paperback. So this is written by Jeff Parker and Mark Andraco, art by David Hahn and Carl Kiesel, with a cover by Alex Ross. It is basically the Batman 66 series and the Wonder Woman 1977 series of Linda Carter and Adam West teaming up in a series of adventures. Some of it takes place in World War II. Some of it takes place later. They play with that format quite a bit. A lot of fun. 144 pages. Super cool collection. Now, you might be going, wait, we're talking about Batman and Wonder Woman in animation. Why are we talking about them in live action? Again, I will get to that later. I promise. Put a pin in that one, folks. Normally retails for $16.99, and you can get it for $9.85, which is 42% off. And I said the magic word Jeff Parker earlier, who is an amazing comic book writer, so you know anything by him is going to be great. And Mark Andraco together with him, and Carl Kiesel and David Hahn. I mean, come on, this thing's a full-on win. So please, go out to InStock Trades and consider picking up both of these trade paperbacks, or at the very least, go up to the Contact Us button when you do buy something from them and let them know you heard about them from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. All right, so we are going to dive in here, David, to Super Friends. Now, we're going to focus in specifically on one particular episode from the fourth season. It's called Lord of Middle-Earth, and we'll talk about our reasons for that. But before we get started with that, I wanted to kind of talk about, like, the season in general and sort of our feelings on it. So it's called World's Greatest Super Friends, right, from 1979?
Yeah, it's the fourth season. So it's after we've watched Challenge of the Super Friends, after we've watched the Wendy and Marvin episodes. This is like, I think there's only six, no,
there's
I think eight episodes
yeah,
this
eight
season,
episodes.
Eight episodes this season, and they are remarkable.
Yeah, they're really exceptional, and I'm glad you mentioned the Challenge of the Super Friends, because it's really strange where Challenge of the Super Friends is celebrated as being, you know, possibly the best of the Super Friends, and that's a fair argument to make. And they're really exceptional because they really focus on the comic book villains. There's a season-long plot. They do away with Marvin and Wendy and Zan and Jaina, and instead you get people like Apache Chief and Samurai and all these great original characters. And then the next year you get to 1979 and they sort of overturn all of that, which is a little weird that all those elements they brought in the year before are gone. But they do these amazing literary episodes. You know, again, it's only eight episodes, but they're leaning on The Arabian Nights. They're leaning on Wizard of Oz, King Arthur and
Camelot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Frankenstein, and for the purpose of this episode, Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's totally wild the way they went. It's a complete different direction. I don't know why they did it. I mean, maybe they perceived Challenge of the Super Friends didn't work. I don't know. Even though it's nowadays incredibly celebrated. But I'm glad they went this different direction. Because for me, growing up, and I'm talking off the top of my head here, maybe I'm wrong. But for me, I'm pretty sure these eight episodes are the episodes I saw more than any others. Like, I feel like these were in super heavy rotation.
These were the scariest episodes. With, I think, one or two exceptions, the scariest episodes of the Super Friends I had ever seen. So I think the only other exception to that is the origin of the Legion of Doom or whatever in the last episode of the Super Friends, where Challenge of the Super Friends, where everybody's dead. I think these episodes atop that level of grotesque monstrosity.
It's funny, we're not sharing notes today. Sometimes David and I do. We're not. Ironically, the next bullet I have on here says this season scared the crap out of me. So I'm right there with you, buddy.
Yeah. Before I think we talk about this particular episode, I think, you know, one of the things that is amazing about this series is that just the opening credits alone are monstrous.
Yes.
It's the world's greatest super friends, Batman and Robin, Superman, Wonder Woman and Aquaman, the Wonder Twins, banded together to protect the universe from the forces of evil, the Super Friends. Dedicated to truth, justice, and peace, for all mankind. The world's greatest super friends.
You're starting with the introduction of the superheroes, you know, so it's like the world's greatest super friends. And you're like, oh, yeah, that sounds cool, right? Superman, Batman and Robin, Wonder Woman and Aquaman and the Wonder Twins. And you're like, OK, I've seen this before. And then you see a UFO
right
come zooming in. And then you see this crazy, almost Dracula looking like thing, Mal Havoc, coming in. And you're like, oh, whoa, that is scary. This guy like looks like a vampire. And then you see like creatures coming out of lava and crazy monsters jumping from the shadows that don't even have names. They're just, and then crazy gigantic spider that traps Batman. And I mean, it is an amazing opening. And if I were a civilian living in this world and know that I only had seven people to protect me against this world of gloom and misery, I would be scared. I mean, I would lose my mind.
Well, there's other stuff, too, because I wrote down all the creatures. You also have this giant snail that's, like, eating a railway. You've got now, the thing in the lava. You mentioned a creature. Looking at it as close as I can, it looks like a robot head to me. It always did growing up. That thing scared the crap out of me. And it's on screen probably less than half a second. But, yeah, it's like it looks to me like a robot head coming up out of the lava as it's just oozing down to me. And his eyes are staring at you, like, right through your soul. And then you get the weeping gargoyle creature from this episode as well. Who's standing there, and then you get this crazy skeleton buccaneer who's got a flying, you know, pirate ship. And
yeah.
A pirate. I love that.
Before we get into the rest of it, I love the gloomy palette. I mean, everything's in these really dark blues and blacks and grays and browns. I don't think there's a moment of, like, light in the whole thing. Everything, like, even when you look at the Super Friends or Aquaman, everything's either at night or against a super dark background, as though they, like, drew it on black paper almost.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's a good observation. And then the one that you and I were messaging about probably the most was in that dark, black, gloomy, sort of palette again, you have this enormous, like, I don't know any other way to describe him other than like a medieval dark lord or a medieval robot or something.
Sort of reminded me of like Shogun Warriors.
Okay, sure.
You know, like this crazy giant mech where you're just like, what is that thing? Is it a Chinese demon monster? Is it a Japanese like kind of crazy robot? It doesn't even have a name. But as Batman is swinging down his bat cable, you're like, what? By mother of all that is holy, is this thing? And how do the Super Friends defeat it?
You look at it and it just demands a story to be told. It really does. It's like you're just dying to know what that was. And the art is so much more intricate than you usually get on the Super Friends too. It looks creepy, and I want to know. I've already built up in my mind like its personality and everything. I'm dying to know his story. Ugh.
Yeah. And then Superman uses his super breath to blow away a genie.
Right. Absolutely. And then you get the title card, World's Greatest Super Friend.
So that means no Hal Jordan.
Right.
Because he's not one of the greatest super friends.
I don't even know if I consider him a friend, really. But yeah. Because Hal Jordan
Co-worker?
Is the worst.
Really is.
But also, we don't get Apache Chief. We don't get Samurai. We don't get El Dorado. We don't get all those other cool characters, too, which kind of bums me out because I love those original characters.
Yeah, and I love El Dorado. I have a secret theory about El Dorado, which is not true, but I want to believe it's true, is that El Dorado is Martian Manhunter in disguise.
Either we have had this conversation before, which is quite possible because we talk a lot off the air when we do these things, or that's a common theory because his powers do line up quite nicely with Martian Manhunter.
Yeah. Everything takes a different tenor when you're like, oh, if I looked at this episode as Martian Manhunter is really El Dorado, kind of like the way Martian Manhunter was Bloodwind.
Spoilers!
In the 90s. Yeah. Sorry. Spoilers for a 25-year-old story.
25-year-old mediocre story.
I said nothing.
I know. You're a professional. I'm not, so I can say that.
yeah, So I was always like, it's fine. Because there was no El Dorado figure, but there was a Martian Manhunter figure. And you're like, you know what? This works for me.
Oh, El Dorado. It's funny. Maybe because he just didn't get enough screen time. But he was always like my secret favorite super friend that like didn't get enough play. I was like, yeah, that guy. That guy's
cool. In later seasons, he battles like this bad guy called Jean Palais, who can like turn artwork into like monsters.
Oh, cool.
And then he's in one of my favorite episodes of Legendary Superpowers show with Gold Kryptonite.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because Gold Kryptonite steals all Superman's powers.
Permanently.
So El Dorado, yeah, permanently. So El Dorado disguises himself as a different superhero or armored guy and fights Kalibak in this arena. And you're kind of like, oh, El Dorado, you're kind of badass.
That's awesome. Okay. Wow. See, I need to rewatch this. I tend to focus more on the Firestorm ones just for the show. But wow, there's so much great stuff out there. Now, one of the episodes that was in this season, this World's Greatest Super Friends in 1979, that we're not allowed to speak of is one called The Universe of Evil, where the evil Superman comes over to our world and then vice versa. And the reason we're not allowed to speak about it is because Chris Franklin, who's part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, he's actually worked it into the bylaws that we cannot do an episode about that particular episode of Super Friends without him present. So we can't even mention it. It's a shame about that. I'll probably have to edit all this out.
You just mentioned it. You literally just broke that rule.
Well, I am one of the co-founders. You know, I got to have some kind of privileges. But anyway, we can
talk about every episode but that one.
Exactly. So yes, the opening credits are just amazing. They are so cool. They get you so excited. And, you know, it's all this amazing creatures out there and villains and scary stuff. And instead, we're going to deal with the Wizard of Oz when you get to that episode.
That episode's super trippy and scary.
I love it so much. It's so freaking weird.
Or the Lex Luthor Strikes Back episode.
I don't even remember that one. Because in advance of the recording, I didn't have a lot of time to watch a lot of episodes. I sort of cherry-picked certain ones here and there, watched a few of the episodes from the season. That is not one I watched. But I don't remember anything about it except there's like a parallel of Otis in it. That's about all I remember.
Yeah, Orville Gump.
His name is Gump. Seriously?
Orville Gump.
Oh, that's amazing.
And yeah, so Lex Luthor is in prison, and Orville Gump has disguised himself as Jimmy Olsen, and Lois and Jimmy go to interview Lex Luthor, and it turns out it's a trap, and Orville has this camera that ends up like basically displacing or kind of changing.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah, and then so then Orville and Lex have escaped, and what you learn is that Lex Luthor has made a deal with Hellion of the Sun.
Yes.
So Lex Luthor and Orville like basically arrange it for all the super friends to get like trapped or captured, and except for Superman and the Hellion of the Sun, and the sun creatures turn the sun red, and Superman loses all his powers.
They have that creepy like screamy voice too. I remember that now.
Yeah. I am Hellion.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's all coming back to me. Oh, I love this season so much.
Yeah.
They had to be in heavy rotation because growing up, like, I knew Challenge of the Super Friends were awesome, but I don't remember seeing a lot of them growing up. Just a few of them here, like the Secret Origins episode and things like that, sure. But for the most part, I don't remember Challenge of the Super Friends. But these eight episodes, obviously some gaps because it's been a number of years, I know I watched over and over and over, especially like the Wizard of Oz episode, especially this one, Lord of Middle Earth. And the reason I picked this one is because this one kind of haunts me because it's creepy. It's really creepy. And, you know, the disfigured super friends always bother me. Mal Havoc, the bad guy, we'll talk about in a minute, just scares the crap out of me even today. It scares me. And it just, I don't know, it's sort of like cemented into my brain. Maybe it's why I don't like Lord of the Rings as much because I like this better. I don't know. But it's scary stuff and it just gets in your head.
So you want to talk about the episode?
Yeah, we should probably do that. That's what we're here for.
Right. So just a really quick recap. It starts with Zan and Jaina and Gleek hanging out by a campfire. And they're camping. So the Wonder Twins are making roasted hot dogs and be like, no, there's nothing better than roasted hot dogs. And then Gleek makes like a weird banana hot dog sandwich. And they're like, you're right, Gleek. Nothing's better than roasted bananas either. And then Gleek like takes the banana, puts stuff on it, throws the peel away and just eats the banana. It's weird. He puts ketchup on the banana peel, puts it, and then he just eats the banana, whatever. Everybody goes to bed. So Zan and Jaina go into their tent. Gleek is like sleeping outside, and then suddenly Gleek sees these weird creatures, and they scurry about, and then they all run out of this mine, and the Wonder Twins have been woken up, and they're like, what's happening? What's going on? You see all these trolls like fleeing from this little cave, and one of them says, Mal Havoc!
That's a really good impersonation.
Thank you. And then it gets crazy from there.
All right, so I will take it from here. So the Wonder Twins and Gleek are, you know, they follow these trolls back. They descend into the cave, and they're shocked to learn that something terrible is in there. And this is amazing red light and glows in their face. It's really well illustrated. And then Gleek runs away in absolute fear and terror, abandoning the Wonder Twins because, yes, he's a space monkey jerk. And Gleek heads back to the Hall of Justice to get help. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice, Batman has perfected, as one is tends to do, a plutonium bombardment chemical that makes his cape absolutely impenetrable to any radiation or energy. About this time, Gleek arrives and asks the Super Friends to help him save the Wonder Twins through a silly sort of charade sort of thing. And they follow Gleek to the spot where the Wonder Twins vanished, and they enter into the cave, and they soon discover the Kingdom of Middle-Earth, which Superman totally recognizes. And it's there that they see there's thousands of trolls that are being forced to work as slave labor. And they're disgusted by this horrible sight. Superman puts the slaver out of commission, and then the Super Friends discover that Zan and Jaina are somehow been turned into these creepy little troll people. And just as they're about to rescue the twins, the demonic Mal Havoc, the chairman and spokesman of my nightmares, appears, and he is ready to fight. Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are all quickly taken out, and Aquaman and Robin don't even lift a finger to try because they're losers. And then Mal Havoc then uses his magic to transform the Super Friends into trolls. The Super Friends are forced to work in the mines as slaves, which is really super creepy, and along with all the rest of these trolls. And the Super Friends don't have their powers either because they've been transformed. Now, Batman and Wonder Woman still have their gadgets, so that's kind of handy. Luckily, they meet the King of the Trolls, who decides to help them. Balderscam is his name. And they escape.
Balderscam, right.
I love that. So Wonder Woman and Batman and Balderscam, they go with Gleek. They sneak past the guards, and they go into the Cave of the Three Deadly Tasks. And the point of this is that they're going to recover the magic ring of Gandor, also referred to as the magic ring of MacGuffin. And by having this ring, it will help them defeat Mal Havoc. They face these three different tasks. First is this living tunnel mouth, then there's the spider people, and then there's the dragon of darkness, which guards this magic ring. And our heroes trick Mal Havoc into helping them get the ring, and they run back to help to the troll slave mines, and sadly the troll king is injured and collapses, but Batman refuses to leave his friend behind. And then in order to defeat Mal Havoc, our heroes have to put the ring on the finger of this giant statue, who is super creepy. It's like this giant gargoyle vampire weeping
Gandor, right?
Is he Gandor? Did they name him?
I think he's it's the Ring of Gandor, right?
Oh, okay.
So I would imagine that that's Gandor.
See, that makes sense. Okay, right. You're using your writer brain. That makes sense. I'm just a nerd who's along for the ride. So yes, good thought. So Wonder Woman fails to get the ring on there. And in the end, Gleek is actually the one who puts the ring on the statue's finger, which awakens and then just utterly destroys Mal Havoc. And the spell's broken. The Super Friends return to normal. And the trolls are all freed. The story ends with Gleek going back to sleep in the camp. And when Gleek awakes, he thinks the entire adventure might have been a dream, except in the shadows he sees the silhouette of a little troll running away, and he passes out in sheer terror. So, the end. So that is my fairly brief recap. I didn't want to spend too much time on it, because odds are, if you're listening to this, folks, you saw it growing up. So, David, what did you think of this episode?
Well, this episode scared the crap out of me, and I'm going to enlist three reasons why.
Okay.
One, that man-eating cave is terrifying. It's literally the reason you don't go into caves, because the stalactites and the stalagmites are its giant teeth. And it's got eyes that are yellow with these black pupils in it. And you're literally scared that these tiny little creatures are going to get caught in its monstrous teeth.
Apparently all you need is a magic lasso to pull out one tooth and then all of them fall down, which is hilarious to me.
Yeah, well, you know, it's got really bad bridge work. So it's like nightmare fuel for a kid, you know, like
little David. Okay.
Yeah. So like, okay, that's bad. So the scary cave creatures are weird. And then you've got the weird spider creatures, right?
Okay.
And they speak in like this almost hissy Cobra Commander like voice where it's like, oh, we're going to eat you.
Right.
Which is scary. And they have these like little, not spider webs, but like spider cages that like plunge.
Yeah.
But like are also suction cuppy. So they're like domed spider things. And you're like, oh my God, these are terrifying. Like so man eating cave is scary. But then like a dozen spider creatures when it's only the four of you. It's Wonder Woman with her lasso, Batman with his gadgets and his cool fireproof cape,
yep.
Balderscam, I don't even think he has any powers or gadgets, and then Gleek, who has a prehensile tail. Great. So you're battling these spidey creatures, and they've got you, like, all surrounded. That's scary.
I'm going to interrupt you for a split second. I'm going to let you finish. I have a list also called Scary as Hell, and there's several items on here, and there's three main scary things, and one of them is the spider people. So we are in agreement on that one. That is nightmare fuel. I don't know whether that's where I get my fear of six-armed spiders or not, even though spiders should have eight. But it's a combination of the voice, and there's a sound effect. There's like this when they descend that just freaks me out.
Yeah, it's very like Cobra Law. Cobra la 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 la. So that's kind of weird. And then so you've got those, and then I think the last thing is the dragon. So that's the two. Then the Dragon of Darkness, the deadliest creature in Middle Earth. Like that's it's very kind of J.R.R. Tolkien kind of. I mean, this whole episode is.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like very smog like creature, and so all those things. It's like, oh, the Ring of Galdor is right up there. We just need to go up there and get the ring, and then you know you have to fight a dragon. So those are the scary things, but that's not the scariest thing in the episode.
Oh, okay. Then maybe our last one's going to pair up. Then we'll each save our big one for the end. Then so for me, it's the spider people. It is the fact that the super friends got transformed into these little troll creatures. Like that is it. I don't know why, but as a kid, maybe it's the body modification issues involved. I don't know, but I was so scared for them that they were transformed into these hideous little creatures. And I mean, they were kind of cute, but still, I felt so bad that their complete will was taken away too, because they're like, they don't have much free will anymore. Like you notice when Xan and Jaina get dragged around, they're like, oh no, not the diamond cage. Okay. And they just wander with them.
Well, Robin is like so exhausted too. Robin, who has beaten, like who has worked with the Super Friends to beat the Legion of Doom. You know, Robin, who's Batman's best partner, is like, I'm so exhausted. I'm so exhausted mining these things, you know, and Aquaman's there and Superman are there, and they're doing their best without their powers to mine, while the rest of them are like Batman, Wonder Woman, and Gleek and Balderscam are all doing their thing. But I feel bad for them. Like, I feel like genuinely bad. I'm like, oh my God, is Robin going to die?
Well, he says, like, mining? He says, I'll be dead in an hour or something like that. I don't remember exact words, but it's like, oh my gosh. So for me, it was just the whole thing that someone else could impose their will upon the Super Friends and change everything about their lives was just freaking me out. So
with one blast, he's just like, pew.
Right.
Like, so he's so powerful. Mount Havoc is so powerful. They can polymorph these Super Friends into trolls, which is crazy. And I just want to get back to this. It's very interesting to me that when Mount Havoc is defeated, which we'll get to in a minute, that the rest of the trolls don't turn into humans.
Right. Well, I guess they were always trolls. So that reinforces the whole Middle Earth thing. It's not like he's been capturing humans. So the spider people, the fact they're transmogrified into trolls, and then the whole idea of the troll slave force, just watching the Super Friends slaving away as they told us in the episode, thousands of other trolls slaving away. I mean, this guy's, he's a slave master. It's horrible. So all of those things freaked me out a lot as a kid, but I think we're both heading towards probably the same big, big, most terrifying thing. So you go ahead, David. What's the most terrifying thing in the episode?
Mal Havoc.
Oh, yes, it is. Absolutely. Please, you go, and then I'll chime in.
What makes Mal Havoc scary isn't just his ability to teleport everywhere, which is, you know, he's a wizard. He can do that. And not just his ability to transmogrify and and Polymorph, the Super Friends. All those things are scary. I think the scariest thing is he looks like reverse Dracula. Like, he looks like this – he's albino. He's got this dark jet black hair, and he wears these, like, almost satanic black and red robes. And then he feels so omnipresent that it's terrifying to me.
It's funny. The robes, you just – they're sort of like what you would expect in, a Hammer Horror or a 1970s horror movie where the big bad guy has his ridiculous over-the-top outfit on, the black and red combo. I mean, it's actually pretty cool looking, but it's very scary. I mean, he's basically Satan in the Super Friends. You know,
yeah.
He acts like the devil. He looks a lot like the devil. He's got all these powers. I mean, he overcomes everything they throw at him. Batman puts him in this like force shield thing, and he just simply waves his hand, and it's boom, boom, boom. It's like it's gone.
One day I must study your primitive technology.
Exactly. He can do anything. And then again, the transmogrifying thing. The guy is terrifying. Today, Dave and I were messaging back and forth, and we found – now, it's not licensed, so I'm not endorsing it. But we found on TeePublic someone had put some Mal Havoc t-shirts out there. And even the picture just looks terrifying. You described it – how did you describe him?
Oh, I described him as something you might see in like an Iron Maiden video.
Exactly.
Like painted on somebody's van in the 1970s.
Right. Now, part of the thing – oh, and he turns Wonder Woman's lasso into snakes, which is super creepy. Now, part of the thing that really sells this character, and I guess we can get into some of the production side of this too, is the voice. Mal Havoc's voice is just so deep, and it's got this gravitas, and it's threatening, and it's scary, and that helps sell the heck out of that.
Yeah, and before we talk about the voice, because I think the voice is something that really sells this, is the melodramatic music. Like, it's haunting to hear this backdrop of dreary underground labyrinthine caves. You know, like, you watch it and you're like, oh my god. It's scarier to me than like watching The Lord of the Rings. You know, it's more haunting. And to think that I don't even know what kind of creature Mal Havoc is, because he doesn't look human.
Right.
But like, I went onto Wikipedia today and it was like, he's a human. I was like, bullcrap.
No way.
Species human. I'm like, nuh-uh, that guy is not human. And he has red eyes. No human I know has red eyes.
He's from one of the rings of hell. He's got to be.
Yeah. He's got the little spiky horns, too.
Mm-hmm.
Weird, like, Van Dyke kind of mustache. I mean, so he's got a mustache, and then he's got, like, this long, almost like forked tongue, but as a beard thing. It's very bizarre. And super dark, bushy eyebrows. So it's, and a red-collared robe. I mean, it's scary. But the voice, ultimately, the voice is what... frightens me.
Yes. Now, before we do that, I just want to mention, you mentioned the music. The incidental music throughout this episode is fantastic. I think a lot of it comes actually from the previous season, from Challenge of the Super Friends, and who knows, it might even go back earlier, because I definitely remember some of the, I shouldn't try and do this stuff. Yeah. I'm not a music guy, but I was humming them in the car today, driving my daughter crazy. But a lot of that stuff was reused from Challenge of Super Friends, but it's just so effectively done here. And I was about the third time I watched this episode, I was noticing how carefully they orchestrate it so they hit the right notes at the right dramatic moments, and it's just so wonderfully done. All right, so let's talk about the voice. All right, so Mal Havoc is voiced by a wonderful voice actor by the name of Stanley Ralph Ross. And do you want to talk to about the folks at home? What else this guy? Just to, if you don't remember his voice, folks, you would remember his voice from other characters. Do you want to mention those?
Yeah, so you might recognize him as Gorilla Grodd from Challenge of the Super Friends.
Woo-hoo!
You might recognize him if you're super into super obscure characters. You might recognize him as Nartan from the Challenge of the Super Friends episode Doomsday.
Okay.
I know. Nartan was the Black Knight of Krypton.
Sweet.
So nobody else cares.
It's not that we don't care. We just can't relate.
Yeah. Like, that's a scary episode. But he's been – Stanley Ralph Ross has been doing voice work for – I mean, he had done so many voices. So it's really interesting to think of him as like Dr. Frankenstein from the Super Friends Meet Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
Or a Brainiac in some of the episodes of Super Friends later on. But he's also been in like Inhumanoids and Richie Rich and the Space Stars. He had such a haunting voice. And he was, if you're a Marvel fan, he was Quasimodo and When Monsters Meet in the Incredible Hulk 1982 cartoon.
Oh, sweet. Okay, cool. I mean, the guy just had so much, I don't know if timber's the right word, but it's just like gravel in his voice that just made you scared. It was just amazing. I don't remember any instance of him playing a hero because he just, that's not the type of voice he carried, but he was absolutely fantastic at it. In fact, in this season, he also did the genie. What was it? Rub Three Times for Disaster, which is a horrible name, but right. Yeah, I went there, but it, just really, really powerful voice. Fantastic. And part of the reason we're harping on this too is because he's known for more than just being a voice actor. Do you want to take a hand and take the lead on this one, or you want me to?
I would love for you to take the lead on it, and then I'll follow you up, because okay. Your pick involves this.
Yes, this is why I picked Batman 66 meets Wonder Woman 77 in the in-stock trades section we did earlier, because he was actually a driving force behind both of those shows. He was a writer on the Batman 66 series, and he also wrote for the shows like The Monkees and stuff like that as well, which is just insane. He was involved in the Wonder Woman's development of that series. He was actually approached originally to work on the previous version that had the Kathy Lee Crosby version, and he totally rejected it out of hand. He declined it because he just felt like it was too far adrift of what Wonder Woman's comic book character was. So when that pilot fails, they come back to him again, and they ask him to get involved, and he becomes very, very involved in the development of the Wonder Woman series. He, in fact, played an instrumental role in choosing Linda Carter and Lyle Wagner for that series. So we think of him just as scary voice guy, but how much more did this guy give us? Unbelievably. Oh, so cool.
And I think it's so much of when I grew up to think of his influence. I was watching Batman in reruns when Wonder Woman came on. That show was on for like 4 years. And to think that he had so much power to sort of create these very, very vivid, not quite comic accurate, but you could see like he could really touch and sort of get into and get engaged with storytelling and how these characters move. And there's a lot of Silver Age and Golden Age stuff in his work, but he was so over the top in his screenwriting that it was amazing.
Until I did the research for this episode, I didn't even know this guy existed. I had no idea. So other than, I mean, I knew there was a voice behind Mal Havoc, but I had no idea on his other connections. And I'm just so glad I had the opportunity to figure that out. Just it enriches it so much.
He wrote a movie called The Weird World of Dr. Goldfoot.
Really?
It's really nuts. So there was a movie called Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine from 1965. This is the 30-minute TV special, and it is super crazy. So, so if you're really into, and Vincent Price is in it as Dr. Goldfoot. Like, if you want something super, super, super quirky, The Wild, Weird World of Dr. Goldfoot is amazing. And he wasn't really involved in Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine, but if you're really interested in something like over the top and really see like how his screenwriting sort of is pushed to like really zany over the top stuff, I recommend it.
That's insane. Well, since we're talking about behind the scenes stuff, I do want to mention a couple of credits. Did you look at the credits closely on this episode?
No, I didn't.
So character design, there are a couple of names that jumped out at me there. There were several names, but two of them were Jack Kirby and Mike Sikowski, which I thought that was really cool. And I don't know whether they're just giving them credit for design of characters that they did in the comics or whether they were actually involved with the Super Friends cartoon. I don't think they were.
They were. Jack Kirby designed Super Friends meets Frankenstein. Jack Kirby designed Henrik Frankenstein, the ancestor of the original Frankenstein, and then designed the Super Monster, which had Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman's powers, and was almost like this vampire-like composite Superman. I'll have to send you some of the designs, but they are crazy over-the-top designs.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's nuts. It is absolutely nuts to see that stuff.
So was Sikowski recognized simply for his contributions to the Justice League comic, or was he also involved in the cartoon?
I think he was also involved in the cartoon.
That's freaking sweet.
Yeah, it's crazy to see sort of this level of, and you can sort of see kind of Kirby-esque stuff in the way that Mal Havoc is designed. I don't know if he had final say in the design, but I think it's really interesting to see Kirby's work because he was doing work for Hanna-Barbera at the time. So it's very interesting to see that level of influence in his work.
You know, the design on Mal Havoc's cloak could very well be Kirby design, because it's got some funky angles and swoops and stuff on there that would line up with him. There were two other credits also mentioned in here that I thought were interesting. Under story direction, there were two gentlemen whose name jumped out at me. Rick Hoberg.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked up Rick Hoberg. You know, I know Rick Hoberg, of course, from a lot of comics, but I didn't realize that he'd helped develop the format for the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. I had no idea.
I didn't either. That's amazing. I love the official handbook of the Marvel Universe.
Everybody loves it.
Oh, hot move? I'm not.
Right? I mean, it's no who's who, but it's still amazing. I got a shill for my own group here. And then the other name was, and I could never say this guy's name right. We're friends on Facebook even, but I don't know how to say his name. Will Mignot, the guy from DNA Agents.
Later went on to work on the Spider-Man cartoons for Marvel in the 90s.
Did he really? Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh, that's super cool. Well, I knew him from DNA Agents and stuff like that, but wow. Okay. So both those names jumped out at me under story direction. I'm like, oh, that's cool. All right. Nice. So, all right. Let's talk some more behind the scenes stuff. So I got a bunch of notes here. We mentioned already Tolkien. So we got to talk about that. J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Obviously, the name of this episode, Lord, as in Lord of the Rings, of Middle-earth. Middle-earth. I mean, come on. So they're not even trying to hide, even a little bit, that this thing is totally a nod towards Tolkien. Well, I should give some backstory, too. If you didn't live through the 70s, or you don't remember the 70s that well, what you might not realize was Lord of the Rings was actually really, really popular at this point. Because 2 years before this, Rankin and Bass had done a TV special about The Hobbit. And then 1 year before this, Ralph Bakshi had done the Lord of the Rings theatrical movie. And if you like Pink Blood, watch that cartoon. So Lord of the Rings is in the public consciousness. It's very, very popular. So I put the question to you, sir. Obviously, this was influenced by the popularity at the time. And obviously, they're trying to capitalize on it. So do you see this episode as more of an homage or a ripoff?
I see it as inspired by.
Okay.
Because I don't think there are enough elements to really sort of, because when I rewatched it, mm-hmm. I was also reminded of Pellucidar. So are you familiar with Pellucidar?
Is that a disease?
No, Pellucidar is a series of novels by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Oh wow, okay. No, I'm not familiar with that at all.
Yeah, so it's literally like Journey into the Center of the Earth civilization. So I certainly see, like, when I think of this, I think of Lord of Middle Earth. A lot of Pellucidar is what Mike Grell's Warlord is based on.
Sure.
So Pellucidar is a hollow earth. So it's a hollow earth idea. And it was invented by Edgar Rice Burroughs, and it's a series of action-adventure stories. So you get At Earth's Core. So you may have heard of that title, At Earth's Core. Mm-hmm. That was designed by Edgar Rice Burroughs. So when they're – I mean, yes, obviously you get the trolls that are kind of Lord of the Ringy. But what I liked about this is that I was really reminded of the creatures, like these sort of like giant snails and these sort of really crazy spider creatures and these sort of gigantic monsters that are sort of in a weird way sort of mutated. So in Pellucidar, there's like a perpetual eclipse and this place called the Land of Awful Shadows. And it sort of reminds me a lot of what we see here. So I feel like they took Lord of the Rings and they took Pellucidar and maybe a little bit of Conan in Mal Havoc's design, kind of like an evil wizard kind of thing.
Sure.
And put it all together and gave us this crazy episode that, yes, it's got a dragon in it, and yes, it's got trolls in it, but the man-eating cave and the crazy spider creatures and the weird spider-eating snails and the weird gargoyle Gandor thing.
That thing's creepy, by the way. The weeping effects will freak me out.
Like, all that stuff, I feel like, yes, there's definitely a Tolkien vibe to it all.
You left out the magic ring that solves the whole mystery. I mean, that's a pretty big thing there.
Right, but it's not one ring to rule it all.
No, but the ring is the MacGuffin which solves the whole problem. You know, you get rid of the ring, you win. In this case, you get the ring on the statue, you win. You've also got, Gandor, which sounds like Gandalf or Gondor. You've got, now you mentioned the spider people. Well, there was a big spider thing in The Hobbit. So, I mean, I'm feeling like there's a lot of ripping off of The Hobbit. But you make a good case, though, for I can't even say the word.
Pellucidar.
Pellucidar. Okay. You make a good case for the Pellucidar sort of influence.
Yeah. I mean, Pellucidar's got like dinosaurs and kind of crazy psychic powers. And it's got like an ant bear, like an ant bear.
Like, that's creepy.
Can you imagine? So that's when I think of the spider creatures. I think it's got giant ants. It's got like these dog-like carnivores. It's got like all these kind of crazy, grotesque creatures. So I feel like there's and you know how Kirby is, and with his stuff is that you can take something like, you know, some sort of Aztec myth and mm-hmm. give it to Kirby, and he makes it into something really kind of deep and obscure. And I don't know how much of a hand he had in this episode, but it's crazy to see sort of all these really bizarre kind of creatures in this episode. And they're grotesque.
Yes.
They're not just like a little weird. They're like grotesque creatures.
You're dead on there. That's a good thought, too. I don't know that I'd really thought about it that way, the horror aspect of that. And that's definitely something else that just adds the scariness to this one. Now, one of the things that I wonder about, too, with the Tolkien aspect is this particular season is well known for a certain aspect, which was that it was not available on home video until 2013.
Yeah.
Almost 35 years. Well, other seasons of the Super Friends were available. I mean, the Challenge of Super Friends were out on VHS and stuff like that. So why was this season took so long? One person posited online that it may have been because the Tolkien lawyers are extremely litigious and may have come after him. But then again, it could have been any of the literary stuff they had this time. Although most of it was in public domain. I don't know if Wizard of Oz was at this point.
Wizard of Oz, I think, was in public domain at the time.
Okay.
At least the books.
Certainly Frankenstein would be. Certainly Jules Verne would have been. Tolkien may have been the only one that wasn't in public domain at this point.
Right.
So I don't know if that played a role. That's complete speculation, but it's an interesting theory as to why it took so long. Or maybe they just didn't think there was money in these episodes, but by golly, I think there was. Oh, they're so good.
It's so crazy because these episodes, we can talk a little bit about it. We're Up Three Times for Disaster, Lex Luthor Strikes Back. There's the crazy Captain Nemo episode with the Kandorians and the Fortress of Solitude. And,
right. And Robot Batman.
Yeah, Robot. Like, he has a nuclear sub, and he made an android Batman that tricked Aquaman. Now, we all know Aquaman's not very smart. Rob Kelly.
We're making friends lesson right here.
but I think the important thing is that these are crazy episodes, and they were largely inspired by literary fiction. So to see this level of depth is crazy. So yeah, Arabian Nights, and yeah, Frankenstein, and Wizard of Oz, that episode is super creepy. But to see that level of depth with these episodes, and to make them genuinely scary, there's something to be said about that.
Yeah.
Now, I have a question for you.
Okay, go for it.
So we don't get a lot of Mal Havoc's backstory. True. In this. So what do you think Mal Havoc's origins are? Now, this is pure speculation, but I would like to think, what are your beliefs about Mal Havoc?
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually have some speculative stuff in here. I'm more like pose questions, but so one of the questions I had was, why does Mal Havoc keep this ring around, you know, in the cave that could destroy him? And how does this magic ring work? You know, I call it the magic ring of MacGuffin, but how does it work anyway, where you put it on the statue and it just blasts Mal Havoc away? So to answer your question, you've got to tie that into his origin. So I'm thinking he's like some sort of demon that's been exiled from hell, or some version of comic book hell, and he is trapped on Earth. And he's having all these trolls mine these minerals that somehow is going to help him maybe reassert himself and take over the throne of hell. And part of his banishment is he can't leave the cave, which is why we've never seen him on the surface. I'm making all this up right now, by the way. And part of the imprisonment there on Earth is that also the tools of his own destruction are surrounding him, and he can do nothing to stop them. And the Gondor statue, the creepy weeping gargoyle statue, is like his prison guard that keeps him there. So that's what I've come up with in these couple of seconds since you asked me.
So my belief is that the reason he's having people mine these things, so if you keep in mind, the diamonds can cut through anything.
Yep.
So I believe that they can cut through the ring, but he doesn't have enough of them to assemble to cut through the ring of Gondor.
Oh, okay.
Which helps explain the mining.
So why does he why is the Ring of Gondor there? Why doesn't he just leave and go somewhere else?
Oh, because I think like Venjor from D&D, he's trapped there.
Okay. All right.
You remember Venjor from the D&D cartoon?
Oh, yeah. Venjor was awesome looking.
Right.
He had like that one horn and everything. He looked so cool.
Right. So I believe that, yeah, he's trapped there. And I think that that's his imprisonment. But he realizes that, oh, by turning people into trolls, I can get them to destroy the ring. I think the magic is too powerful for him to destroy on his own.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Since we're talking about stories that weren't told, there's another story here too, by the way, that occurred to me on the third viewing of this episode. When it opens, all of these trolls are running out of the cave, right? They've all escaping Malhavik. I counted 35 trolls on screen, and that's just the ones we saw. The question becomes, how did they get away? What facilitated their escape out into the real world? There's a story there to be told. I don't know what it is, but we've seen the prison. We see how hard it is to escape. How did these guys get away? So there's something there that would have been interesting.
Yeah, well, I think Balderscam does it.
Oh,
I think Balderscam frees them. Because he frees the super friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was a mass exodus because those diamonds that they're mining can cut through anything. And I think Balderscam arranged a prison break.
That's a very good possibility. Also, by the way, Balderscam, worth mentioning. You know, I remember cartoons in the 70s had to start throwing, and in the 80s had to start throwing, like, educational factoids in there.
Yes.
In this one, it was Batman saying, "We don't leave our friends behind, Balderscam." That's about the only educational thing you can get out of this.
Well, and fireproof capes solve everything.
That's true. That's true. You know, I wonder, did Batman ever have his fireproof cape in future episodes?
I don't know, but I was looking through his stats recently.
Okay.
And it says he has a fireproof cape. And I was like, hey, that's cool. I didn't know that before. But yeah, his cape is fireproof.
Very cool. So I've got lots of little notes that I'm just going to sort of rapid fire through some of these. You jump in at any point here. I love that when they go into the Kingdom of Middle Earth, Superman just declares, it's the Kingdom of Middle Earth. Like he knows exactly what it is. He's, you know, either been there a bunch. Maybe he's got a brochure on his desk. Like
he has X-ray vision.
Okay. No one else in the Super Friends goes, well, what? Huh? They just like, okay, let's go.
Well, keep in mind two things. I don't know how canon this is, but keep in mind this came out after the Superman movie.
True.
So I think a lot of kids are coming from the Superman movie thinking that all of Earth's knowledge is given to Clark in that little sphere he crashes in on. So he probably learns about Middle Earth in the Superman movie when he's that time it takes him to come from Krypton to come to Earth. All of Earth's knowledge is given to him.
Dude, you either have really thought about this or you're very quick on your feet. One or the other. I'm impressed.
I've seen the Superman movie a lot.
Right. So I plug for Superman Movie Minute right here on our network. So got to talk about the trolls for a second. I absolutely love the way Batman looks. His cowl specifically when he's a troll. His cowl looks so cool because the bat ears are so freaking tall. They look awesome.
It reminds me of Kelly Jones. The way
yes.
that Kelly Jones used to draw Batman.
Yeah, it actually makes Batman look a little creepier. And his face is a little, like, crunchy and stuff like that because he's a troll. But I think Batman, at least from his neck up, looks pretty sweet.
Yeah. Wonder Woman as a troll disturbs me.
It's very sad how she's very unpleasant. Like, you don't really realize how much until she transforms back to, like, the beautiful Wonder Woman. You're like, oh, wow. Okay, she's super hot. I kind of forgot because she looked so horrible for a while there.
You know, I always had a crush on Jaina and not on Wonder Woman.
Okay.
Because I thought when I was 10, she was more my age.
She was more in your range. Okay.
Yeah.
More attainable. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, more attainable than Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman was like perfect. And Jaina was like flawed. She had a doofy twin brother. Okay. Like, I can hang out with that in a space monkey on a date. Sure.
So, all right, let's talk about their voices. All right, so when they get turned into trolls, right, they get these high, squeaky voices. And I started speculating. I'm like, okay, is that like a post-production modulation? Or more fun, the answer I want it to be, is they had actors sucking on helium in the recording booths. That's what I really hope happens.
They would be so high.
Exactly. Could you imagine Casey Kasem getting, like, blasted out of his mind, mouthing off to people after sucking on too much helium? It would have been a freaking riot.
I think that would be amazing.
I was doing Scooby-Doo when you guys were in diapers. So shut up! There's a little too much prehensileness in this episode for me. It starts to freak me out a bit. You mentioned Gleek's tail already, but the cave has a prehensile tongue, which is
yes.
creepy. The dragon has a prehensile tail. And to some extent, the snails have prehensile eye stalks. Like they're throwing the spider people around. Creepy.
Yeah, it's nuts. But it's so monstrous because we as human beings, I mean, I don't know about you because I've never met you in person. I have no prehensile tail.
My toes are pretty good at curling, but not too much.
Can they throw a ring onto Gandor?
I am just waiting for the opportunity to find
out. Great. That's fantastic. So I know you have a bunch of questions, but my question to you is it a dream or is it real?
I'm telling you, you are reading my stinking notes because that is my next item as well. My first statement about that is, was that even necessary to throw that in there? I kind of wish they hadn't, but maybe because the episode was so monstrous and so weird and crazy, they felt like they had to give the kids an out, you know, from a continuity perspective to let them know this isn't real, or maybe they didn't want to give Gleek that much credit. I don't know. I kind of have to say it was a dream, but I don't want to. Does that make sense?
No, I don't think it was a dream. Here's what I think. I think that after they put the ring on Gandor and everybody became back to normal, is that their minds were wiped and only Gleek remembers the reality.
Oh, okay. That's kind of cool. I could dig that.
Because that's why he sees the creatures again. And he's like, oh, I'm going to drift back to sleep. But I believe that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was real and the only person who remembers is the space monkey.
That seems sort of sad, but I think Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and Aquaman and Robin would rather forget being trapped as trolls. So maybe it's for everyone's best that everyone's forgotten. But so, does that mean there's still a bunch of trolls underground, and what are they doing with themselves now that they're not slaves?
Yeah, I don't know.
They have their own society, but clearly they still come up to the surface because Gleek saw one.
Right. Well, my question is, what do they get when they come to the surface? Like, what? You're a troll. You've come to the surface. What are you going to do?
Picnic baskets.
What? Making baskets?
No, they're stealing picnic baskets.
Oh, and bringing them back to Middle Earth?
It was a Yogi Bear joke. You could have gone with it, but you just had to make it too real.
Oh, hey, boo-boo. Let's get us some picnic baskets.
See, there you go. Now you're on board with it.
Done. Hey, boo-boo. What are you going to do? My question is, you know, when they leave, do the trolls, I guess the trolls are always trolls and they're not human, but I'd like to believe that they are. And maybe when they leave the enchantment of Malhavik, they'll become normal humans. And maybe Malhavik had almost like a changeling thing where people would come in and they'd be like, oh, this is a nice little cave. And we're like random cave explorers, but their families are missing them. And these people have been abducted. And when these trolls finally become human and come back into society, I've really thought about this episode a lot.
Clearly.
what is it? Like, do they become normal people? Do their families miss them? Are there posters, every wanted posters, like find my lost daughter, find my wife, oh my god, find my whatever, like my grandmother was a there's like missing and exploited family members, you know. I don't know. How long have the trolls been down there? I mean, there's a lot to think about with this episode.
All right, Stephen King Jr., now that you've spooked me here with your, I'm going to poke holes in your theory. So if Malhavik was transforming humans into trolls, and then you follow your previous thought of logic, which was Superman was aware of the Middle Earth where these trolls lived, Superman would have been aware that they were all slaves all this time.
Yeah, well, Superman's a dick, as we've learned previously from internet memes.
That is true.
It's Superman's dick. Or maybe Superman knew that when he went into the kingdom of Middle-earth that Malhavik was all-powerful, and that Superman is vulnerable to magic, and only with the combined powers of the Super Friends was he able to eventually defeat Malhavik.
Wow. Okay. We need to find more things for you to do. Speaking of
Superman's the first one taken out by this kind of crazy Malhavik hand that just slams Superman into the ground.
That's true. And part of this is just Superman's susceptibility to magic. They don't reference it in the episode, but those of us who are total geeks know that, like, oh yeah, Superman going up a magic guy, you're a fool, don't do it, Superman! And then, of course, he gets wiped out pretty quick. But, oh, you know what? God, the sound effects in this whole episode are so good. Like, when Malhavik shoots, there's this, you know, there's this twangy wah, 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 sort of noise to his powers that are just, oh, it's so good! I love it so much. All right, I do have a bunch of other just useless comments. I'll skip all of them except for this last one, which was what I call, instead of Super Friends, the Useless Friends, which was Zan, Jaina, Aquaman, and Robin, did absolutely nothing in these entire episode. They never once demonstrated their powers. They never did anything superhuman. They never really helped anybody. It's pretty, well, I guess Zan and Jaina attempted to, but they immediately got kidnapped, and they did get that awesome red lighting effect on their faces, which was cool. But other than that, none of them did anything this episode.
Well, to be fair, one of the things that is really interesting about how these episodes are set up mm-hmm. is that we only get three or four Super Friends in any given episode. So, for example, in Super Friends Meet Frankenstein, all we get are four Super Friends. We get Robin, Batman, Wonder Woman, Superman, because Aquaman has taken the Wonder Twins and the Wonder Twins to Atlantis. Oh, we get Gleek too. Yeah, and then in 20,000 Fathoms or whatever, we right. don't get Superman. We get Superman very briefly. And
it goes off to Saturn to hang out right. with Wonder Woman.
Right. But then it's really just an Aquaman, Batman, and you get a little bit of Gleek and Wonder Twins in it. But they've really done a good job of sort of segmenting and breaking these teams off into groups. I want to say kind of like Jerry Conway did in the Justice League run he did, where he'd find ways to pair off the heroes. And that I found really interesting, because you got some really nice, I mean, these episodes aren't known for deep character depictions, right. but you still got some really cool interactions with like these characters hanging out with and being a part of a different team dynamic.
Well, the pairings go all the way back to even the Justice Society and the All-Star Comics. They used to do that, where they'd say, okay, we're going to put these two characters off on this part of the mission and these two characters in this part of the mission. So it's sort of like that, but you're just saying they spread it across the season, which makes sense. I get that. All right. So in wrapping up, this episode is one of the more beloved ones for me. It really sort of imprinted on my mind as a kid. I always think back to it when I think, in fact, I've referenced it on a bunch of different episodes where I mention it over the years on this show. And I'm so glad we got a chance to take a deep dive into it. And I'm so glad we learned so much more about the behind the scenes stuff going on. I love this episode. I love it even more now. And I think I'll be having nightmares about Mal Havoc tonight. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Mal Havoc, I would say, is probably in terms of like levels of Super Friends threats, probably the greatest or up there. I would say he's comparable to Darkseid in the Super Friends. Here is this all magical creature who in a lot of ways is more successful than Darkseid because he's able to really harm the Super Friends in demonstrative ways. Like Darkseid would like shoot his Omega beams or whatever, but here I was generally frightened for the Super Friends. Like the most scared I was with Darkseid was like, I mean, he always wanted to marry Wonder Woman, whatever. But I think the only episode I was really terrified when Darkseid starts showing up is when he has gold kryptonite. And you're like, oh my God, Superman is going to lose his powers permanently.
Right.
Like, but that was the greatest threat. I think Mal Havoc, especially voiced by Stanley Ralph Ross, is like really preeminently powerful.
It's a shame you never saw him again either. Because I mean, unless I'm mistaken, you never get his name in Super Friends. He never breaks through to other DC media. Is he ever referenced other than that one t-shirt that's illegal on TeePublic, is he ever seen of again?
No, he is never seen. I mean, he's one of like over 300 characters across various DC media that have appeared in other media but have not actually appeared in the comics.
300. It almost sounds like you've done some research on this, David.
I've done so much research on this, Shaq.
300 characters. Oh, my God.
Over 300 characters. So we see, obviously, Mal Havoc, who we've talked about here. But there are characters like Red X from the Teen Titans cartoon that is never broken through.
Which version of Teen Titans? You got to help me out here.
The Teen Titans cartoon from the 2000s.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. Yep.
Who is kind of like Jason Todd, but maybe not. He's a scary guy. He's like thieving powers. He shoots like these red X's of like weird sort of like gooey stuff at people. He can take out the entire Teen Titans team. He's kind of like this super bad guy that works with Deathstroke. You're like, oh, that guy's scary. Or I mentioned earlier Nartan, who is he's in one episode of Challenge of the Super Friends for all of 2 minutes. And he's called the Black Knight of Krypton. And he is in the dimensional world of Quard. So Superman is teleported to the dimensional world of Quard. And Nartan, who's also voiced by Stanley Ralph Ross, rides a unicorn, has the powers of Kryptonian, but then he has a lance that has got Sinestro-like powers that can also create green kryptonite dragons.
I totally remember this guy now. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So he's in an episode called Doomsday, and you're like, oh my goodness, this guy literally looks terrifying. And you only see him for 2 minutes, and the only reason Superman escapes is that he tricks Nartan into like creating a blast so powerful that it warps Superman back to Earth.
See, that's a character that could have crossed over. That would have been good.
Yeah, I mean, like, imagine being a Kryptonian with the powers of Sinestro Corps.
Crazy.
I know. So, and there are just dozens of other characters. I mean, you think about, like, you could go through, like, the Superboy cartoon with Gilbert Gottfried as Knick-Knack, who has never broken through. Or I mentioned earlier, like, Galatea from the Justice League cartoon, who's kind of like an analog to Power Girl.
Oh, right. Okay, I remember her. Sure.
Yeah, Galatea. Or, like, Cairo from the Filmation animated TV show with Green Lantern. Do you remember time? Cairo?
No, I don't.
So when Filmation did the Aquaman, Teen Titans, Flash, Hawkman, and Green Lantern cartoons, mm-hmm. rather than doing Tom Kaluta, Green Lantern was paired with a Venusian named Cairo. So you're like, oh, yeah. But and also, if you think about characters from, like, there's Luminous from Superman the Animated Series, or Calendar Girl from Batman the Animated Series. You know, or
Calendar Girl. Interesting. Is that just a variation on Calendar Man, or is it a whole
different? Yeah. So her real name is Paige Monroe.
Okay.
And she's like sort of like Betty Page and sort of like Marilyn Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
She was a former actress. She was voiced by Celia Ward, and yeah, she was voiced by Celia Ward, and she basically had a calendar theme. So she would attack with Easter eggs 1 year, and New Year's Eve she would like dress as like the Grim Reaper, and she carried a scythe. And her costume was this white mask, kind of like Madam Mask from Marvel.
Okay.
But it was a white mask, and she would wear different colors per season. I think the episode was called Mean Seasons. And she was just in her 40s, and she was just not cast in anything, and she sought revenge against Hollywood.
Wow. So she doesn't break through, but Condiment King does.
Yes. But also, like, Razor and Aya from the Green Lantern animated series don't break through.
That's surprising that they've never made it, because they were pretty big, you know, pretty big in that series.
Well, you know, the most prominent character who's never broken through, I think, is Phantasm.
Hmm.
From Mask of the Phantasm.
Sure, sure. Well, in a lot of ways, that was just, a lot of people, if I remember right, thought that was sort of a riff on the Reaper from year two.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you could certainly say that that's a riff on the Reaper, but you have Andrea Beaumont, which could have been a love interest. So, yeah, the visual disguise of Andrea Beaumont is, yeah, definitely like kind of like as the Phantasm is definitely like the Reaper. But imagine Andrea Beaumont as a love interest for Bruce Wayne.
Right. That would be fascinating.
Yeah. But also there are all these characters, for example, in Power Records that we never see. So we never see like Plastic Man, Battered Dr. Steel, or Metamorpho, Battle Fumo, the Fire Giant, or Aquaman, Battle the Dehydrator. None of these characters have actually made their way into the comics.
So the question is, how many of these characters are caught up with rights issues? Like the Power Records characters are, you know, that company doesn't even exist anymore. Was it Peter Pan Records or whatever it was?
Yeah.
Are those characters still owned by them, which makes them not able to cross over? Same thing with the Super Friends characters?
I don't know. Like, it's interesting. It's interesting because I don't know how many of these 300 characters were like created and owned by the media company or some sort of licensing deal.
Mm-hmm.
But like, why hasn't Bob the Goon showed up?
Okay.
Or
sure.
Or the Kabuki twins from the Batman TV show, who were Penguin's little assistants, who wore little Kabuki masks. Or like, why hasn't, for example, the Hostess Twinkie characters, you know, like Ice Master in the Marvel Universe crossed over, but you don't see like Terra Cobalt or the Topsy Turvy Man or Jet Set Jesse or the Vacuum Vulture. You don't see any of them show up.
Right. Some of them are fun. Some of them could. I mean, I want to say, was it Bendis or somebody online was saying they wanted to use all the Hostess characters in a story someday. And I think a lot of people have felt that they wanted to do that, and it could be a rights issue. Now, sometimes these characters do cross through or break through, but they're not used to their best advantage. For example, like, the Wonder Twins series right now, it's only on like issue one or two, is pretty fun. But before that, the Wonder Twins, I don't feel like were ever really used properly when they broke through.
Right, because they were in Extreme Justice.
Exactly, and that was not fun at all for them. Or, El Dorado. I mean, he's broken through barely, but it hasn't been used effectively. You know, Apache Chief and Samurai, I think those guys have broken through at some point or another.
Right. What's interesting about Samurai is he has the powers of a new god. Did you know that? That's how he got his powers?
Explain.
So he was an archaeology professor, and he was imbued. High Father wanted to create more humans that were empowered with the powers of the new gods in order to help defeat Darkseid. And that's what happened to Samurai. He got the powers.
Of,
so Samurai has several like elemental powers, and he was a history professor. And then I think it's revealed on the back of his superpowers card that High Father of the new gods granted him special powers that are on the back of his file card, but they include like invisibility, the ability to shoot fire, the ability to obviously channel the powers of the wind. And now I think he is part of, I don't know what it's called.
Global Guardians?
But he's not part of Global. I don't remember the name of the team, but he's on like Monster Force or something in Japan. He's on a like a specialized.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it's like Monster Force 5 or whatever it's called. But yeah, that's
Big Hero 6.
Yeah, like Big Hero 6 or whatever. And then, like, for example, I mean, I think we saw him later, but he may have broken through. But Ashley Halberstam was also a British Egyptologist, and he ended up getting the powers of Golden Pharaoh.
Oh, jeez. Now, the only place I remember Golden Pharaoh was the action figure, which was like clearly one of these where you look and go, what was Kenner thinking? They obviously, some Kenner exec felt like creating their own character. But I want to say he made it into the Superpowers 3 miniseries, the not necessarily beloved Superpowers 3 miniseries. Other than that, I don't know that Golden Pharaoh ever broke through anywhere. I mean, I suppose he may have at some point. They redid action figures of him years later in the DC Classics line, so there's some love for him. Oh, gosh.
Right. His only comic appearance was in the third Superpowers series.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know this, but he can channel the power of the pyramids to generate energy blasts through his mystical staff.
Okay.
And he has glider wings that enable flight.
Isn't he the one that... No, I'm thinking of Cyclotron that can take his face off. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, that's super creepy.
It is. It's so creepy. It's like a Manhunter. So, ugh. But, so, all right. So, we've established there are tons and tons and tons of Super Friends characters that never broke through, which is disappointing. And there are some Super Friends characters that did break through, but not usually in the way we would have wanted, unfortunately. So, that's a shame. Now, David, is there a place where people could see some of these 300 characters, perhaps?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter, and I will put the link to these amazing, obscure characters in the show notes.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yes, David has been posting, I don't know if you've posted all 300 characters by now, but David has been posting these characters on Twitter for a while now, and it's just unbelievable, and it's so crazy.
Yeah, it's up to, I think, 228. I'm going to stop at 300. But yeah, so, and some of these characters, you're like, it's interesting to see it because there's such a nostalgic element to it all. At least for me, because I look at these characters and I'm like, oh, right, this character scared the crap out of me. And some of the characters, I really try to be very objective about it. I try not to judge any character because every character is somebody's favorite. But you look at some of these characters and you're like, why does this character exist? Or I understand that, for example, in order to get some of these characters may have been embargoed. You know, like Devil Ray, for instance, who appeared in Justice League Unlimited, was an analog of Black Manta because Black Manta was under the Aquaman embargo. So, you know, there's some characters who are like sort of skirting the level of obscure, and you know that they were only designed to be like one-shot characters. But it's really interesting to see like Steam Lantern from the Green Lantern animated series. You'll probably never see him again, but he was super cool for that particular story.
That's a cool name. That's a great play on that. I like that. Cool.
Yeah, it's really awesome to see these characters and go like, oh, huh, I had no idea that there was a Black Hawk TV show. for instance.
There was?
A Black Hawk, and not TV show, but a Black Hawk serial.
Oh, okay, yes. All right. Oof. All right, you threw me for a second there. I'm like, what? Oh, wow. Well, we've talked about that people can find this stuff on your Twitter. David, why don't you tell the people at home what you're working on right now, what you've got in the pipeline, what is coming out from you creatively?
Yeah, so right now I'm working on, I just finished, The Only Living Boy Omnibus, which went on sale late last year, which is 400 and plus pages of action adventure fiction that I think people will really love, especially if they liked old Saturday morning cartoons like Thunder the Barbarian or Johnny Quest. It's definitely inspired by that kind of storytelling. And then this, later this spring, we have The Only Living Girl, which is a spin-off series of the Only Living Boy, and it's about the daughter of a mad scientist and how she sort of makes her way. She sort of sleeps through the apocalypse, and so it's all about how she comes to grips with this new world.
Oh, cool. Only Living Boy, folks, if you haven't checked that out, it's absolutely amazing. The omnibus is gorgeous, by the way, David. It's absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. I'm glad you like it.
You guys really need to be checking this out if you haven't checked
and
it out.
And Steve Ellis illustrates both books. So, and they, yeah, the book looks absolutely gorgeous.
When does Only Living Girl hit the shelves?
It is available everywhere. So bookstores, Target, Amazon, on May 14th.
Fantastic. Oh, this is just right around the corner by the time this comes out. Awesome.
Oh, one of the things we forgot to mention,
mm-hmm.
today, the day we're filming this, is Jose Luis Garcia Lopez's birthday.
Praise
so
be
as we're
name.
Talking about as we're talking about the Super Friends and Samurai and Golden Pharaoh, he had so much influence on not necessarily the Super Friends, but everything that we loved about DC Comics in collectible 3 3/4 inch form.
Well, and by the time you get to the final season of Super Friends Galactic Guardians, they really are based on his stock art by that point. So it did influence Super Friends by the end, certainly.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating. So I think we've brought everything full circle. We've talked about Jack Kirby and his work and his influence on Super Friends. We've talked about Stanley Ralph Ross, and we've talked about Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name.
Awesome. Well, that's a wonderful way to wrap this up. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you finished your cereal by now. If not, it's pretty soggy.
I hope they're on their second bowl.
As they should be. I remember eating probably a whole box of Cocoa Puffs in front of the TV watching all these Saturday morning cartoons when I was a kid.
My favorite cereal was Captain Crunch, and the fact that it tore up the roof of my mouth was just the price I paid for perfection.
I've never heard anyone reference that, but I always think about that with Captain Crunch. It absolutely did the same to me too.
Yeah, and I'm just like, this cereal's so good, but why is my top of my mouth bleeding?
It was a price that was worth paying, especially once they started introducing like Crunchberry version. Oh, so good.
That's so good.
So I guess this is where we say goodbye, and you and I go off and have our nightmares about Mal Havoc.
Yeah, and one of the things to keep in mind about Mal Havoc is as you go to sleep, remind yourself that his name literally means evil destruction.
That's a happy note. I like talking about the comic creators instead.
Sweet dreams, Zach.